Welcome back. I hope you got good refreshment during our break. We have this morning had, I think, virtually everybody who's crossed the stage has mentioned, has highlighted, has referred to the Primary Financial Statements Project. So now, instead of just talking about it in passing, we are here to bring you the PFS Power Team to give you really all you need to know for the forthcoming consultation on this project. Now, I'm going to introduce the people who will be presenting this session, and then I'm going to flee the stage happily. To my immediate left is Nick Anderson. Nick has been a board member at the ISB for 2 years now. He joined us with a background as a buy-side investor, including I don't know if I should reveal this in public, 30 years of experience as a global equity portfolio manager, and had been active in consultative groups like the Corporate Reporting Users Forum, CRUF. So Nick is chairing this session. Nick has very intelligently recruited the leadership of the PFS team from a staff perspective to Nick's. Immediately next to Nick is Rachel Nubley. Rachel is the overall leader on better communications, and she took this up as light relief after a number of years working on the conceptual framework project, and is doing a great job in terms of pulling together a number of quite different strands in that project. And to Rachel's left is Aida. Aida is the brains behind PFS. Not that the others don't have brains, but she has really been the driving force in terms of bringing it to completion. I saw those management skills when I worked with her on the IFRS 13 fair value measurement post-implementation review that she managed incredibly well. So we have high expectations for both the content and the management of this project and also of this session. With that, over to you, Nick.
Thank you, Mary, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to our session on primary financial statements. So, as Hans mentioned in his opening comments, we plan to issue an exposure draft before the end of the year, and we'll be consulting on the board's proposals during the first half of next year. So the aim of our session this morning is to help you prepare for that consultation. We would like to make this session actually as interactive as possible, and we have some questions for you as we go through, but we also welcome your questions if you could submit those via Slido, and we'll be pausing as we go through the presentation to address those. So we have a warm-up question for you to begin with on Slido, which is about how important is improving performance reporting. So if we could have that question up now, please, Gloria. I'm not sure that's the question. Gloria, is that? That's not the question. Do we have that on Slido? Okay, we might.
The answer. So we have 30 answers to questions, so please keep answering.
Let's move. If you could answer that, we'll see if we can come back to the answer in a moment. But let's move on in the meantime. Go on then. You tell me, Rachel.
Okay, we have 43 answers so far on that question. The overwhelming majority are going for A. So we've got 65% on A. Improvements to financial to performance reporting are essential to improving quality of financial reporting. We've then got 34% on it would be good to make some improvements. So I think overall there is overwhelming support for the idea that we should be doing something in the area of performance reporting.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thank you. So Improving performance has been, or the presentation of performance, has been a long-standing request from analysts and users. The last time we formally asked about how we should use our resources during the last agenda consultation in 2015, this project was identified as a high, if not the highest priority by the users of financial statements. And if I think back over the 30 years of my career in markets, I'd flag two big developments in financial reporting and analysis that have really mattered. The first has been the adoption of IFRS standards, which has led to much more comparability in measurement and recognition. But the second, which perhaps isn't as well appreciated, has been the change within the asset management business from managing global domestic portfolios to global mandates and international mandates. So often there, as an investor, you're managing a much larger opportunity set than before. So much greater value is placed on comparability and how consistency can help comparability through presentation. So this really does matter. It's very important to users. But it will also have an impact, a potential impact, on every single preparer. So this is why the consultation is so important. So the project is part of our work on better communications. And here we have developed a series of proposals to improve how financial information is communicated. And it's, our focus has been particularly on the statement of profit and loss. In a moment, I'll hand over to Aida, who will talk through the project scope in details. But just to give you an outline of how we've got to where we are today, the board agreed the project scope for primary financial statements at the end of 2016. And then we spent really the last 2.5 years developing those proposals. 2 years into that process, we felt that we had enough information about the problems we're trying to solve, but also potential solutions, that the project went onto the standard setting agenda, and also that we should consult via exposure draft, then via a discussion paper. We feel we have enough evidence here, the issues are clear enough. So the board finished its deliberations in July of this year. We're now working very hard, especially the staff, in the process of preparing that exposure draft, as I say, for publication in December, and the comment period will last until the 30th of June next year. So we have one more polling question for you before I hand over. How can we help you with your outreach in your jurisdiction? Is that through providing presentation materials? Can we make either members of the staff or the board available to participate in outreach? Or can we help you in terms of organising your meetings? And I think there's also there an option, an open question, or anything else we can do. So can we, let's have, see if we get up to 70 like Mary was aiming for. Okay, well, it's about most wanting, 60% wanting to see, look into our eyes and help them with proposals, either to work with the staff or board members to participate in outreach. 50% providing presentation materials, and then 10 to help organise a meeting. So, but please come and talk to us, whatever way we can help with this. This is a very important project. Let us know and we'll do our best to help you. So with that, I'm going to pass over to Aida, who's going to look at some of the key proposals and then drill down into some of the questions around particularly the formatting of the statement of profit or loss. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you all. Lots of familiar faces. And as Mary and Nick mentioned, we are busy preparing a Christmas present for you, which is 150 pages of exposure draft on primary financial statements. So if you haven't made any plans for holidays yet, don't worry. We will keep you very busy with this. Um, So what I will do is I will spend about 15 minutes to talk about the board's proposals for new subtotals in the statement of financial performance. But before, and then we will spend a few minutes to answer any questions that you have in relation to those subtotals. So please, I think you've used Slido in the previous session, so feel free to put a question to Slido if there is anything you would like us to clarify or explain as I go through the proposals. And Nick has kindly agreed to look at those questions, and then we will have opportunity to discuss a few of them at the end. And then after that, Rachel is going to spend about another 15 minutes going through the rest of the proposals in the project, and then we will similarly have opportunity to answer any of your Slido questions on those proposals, and then we will have a couple of polling questions for you at the end of the session. But before I dive into the beauty of operating profit and how the board has proposed to define it, I just want to give you a quick overview of how this scope of the project came about. And as Nick mentioned, this was all informed by the last agenda consultation where we heard that improving performance reporting should be a priority, and this has been reflected in your first in your responses to the first polling survey, where most of you also agreed with this statement. This didn't give enough of the guidance to the board as to what exactly needs improving. So what we have done following that is we have done a targeted user outreach to understand what are the key problems in performance reporting that the board should be focusing its resources on. And in this outreach, we heard three common themes from users we spoke to. First was that there is not enough comparability in the statement of financial performance, that information, the structure and the content of statement of financial performance above profit or loss is really quite different between entities, even when you look at entities that are in the same industry. So they've asked the board for more comparable information in statement of financial performance. Another common theme we have heard is relation to alternative performance measures, or what we sometimes refer to as non-GAAP. So users have told us that these non-GAAP numbers can provide useful information, but sometimes there's just not enough clarity as to how they've been calculated or how they relate to IFRS numbers. And sometimes users just struggle with finding the information because it can be scattered all over the annual report. And the final theme is an overarching theme which we have heard, and not just in this project, but in other projects we are working on, which is insufficient disaggregation, a lack of relevant information in financial statements. And to give you an example, often users come and tell us, look, when I go through financial statements, I often find these large, large items that are described as other and nothing more. And it's very hard for me to decide, then, is this material, is this relevant? How do I build it into my models? Information is just too aggregated. So they asked the board to improve how information is disaggregated in the financial statements. So these three teams have introduced the slide you've had on for a while, and they've guided the board scope of the project. So the first thing the board is doing on the project is to introduce a new subtotals to help comparability of information about financial performance, which is the number one you see here. And then the second, so the number 2 to 4 on this slide, are all proposals that are helping to improve disaggregation in financial statements. And you see here we have a combination of things. We have a number 2, which is a general principles and guidance on disaggregation. And then there are also some specific proposals which Rachel we will explain a bit later on. And then we also have a proposals for introducing a note, requiring entities to provide a note disclosure about some of the non-GAAP information that the board has defined as management performance measures. Again, I will keep you in suspense about this for a little while until Rachel comes to that. And finally, another area in the scope of the project, although I have to say it is not a major review of statement of cash flows, but the board has included in the scope of this project some limited changes to improve how consistently information of the cash flows is presented. So this is a quick overview, and what the board is expecting to get as a result of these proposals is, of course, significant improvements in financial reporting. And I think three things we expect as a result of this project. Number one is more relevant information provided to users of financial statements, in particular about financial performance. Number two is more comparable relevant information provided to users, again, around financial performance. And number three is to improve transparency and discipline of information provided about some of the non-GAAP numbers, which we define as management performance measures. So with that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about proposals for subtotals, and operating profit being the first one of those. So before I go on into how the board has proposed to define operating profit, I just want to share a little bit of what we have found in practice. And as you all know, IS1 does not require entities to present operating profit. It requires only profit or loss to be presented. And it says entities should present additional subtotals when they provide relevant information. So what happens in practice is that many companies do provide additional subtotals, and operating profit is most common one of these additional subtotals, but because it's not defined by the standards, entities define it themselves, and of course what happens is that they make different decisions as to what they include or exclude from this subtotal. So what you see on the slide is examples of some things that are commonly classified differently between entities. And, you know, this example of net interest on pensions is something for years and years we've been hearing users complain about, because they say, I really don't know where I will find it when I pick up a set of financial statements. It can be anywhere. It would really help to have some consistency of classification of this. And, you know, you can see some of the other examples of inconsistency. And just to illustrate, so we have done a little bit of research of practice to see, is this inconsistency really a big issue? So what we have done is we looked at a set of 85 sets of financial statements from companies all over the world, and we found that maybe half of those presented operating profit. And then what we have done is say, okay, can we see how they calculated operating profit? And we found at least 9 different definitions of this operating profit in these 40 entities. And I say at least 9 because in some cases it wasn't even clear what was included or not included in this operating profit. So clearly there was a need for the board to do something about it. And what has the board done? So let's look at that. So the board is proposing to require all entities to classify particular income and expenses in operating category and present operating profit or loss as a result of income and expenses in this category. And the objective of investing category, operating category and operating profit subtotal is to include all income and expenses that arise from entities' main business activities. Bear in mind, this is objective. It is not how operating profit is defined. So the way the board has gone to define operating profit is indirect. In other words, the board has concluded that entities, in addition to their operations, they would have investing and financing activities, and they would also have income taxes and discontinued operations, which IS1 already requires entities to present separately today. So what the board has done, said, let's define investing and financing, and then any income and expense that is included in profit or loss, that is not discontinued operations, not income tax, and not related to investing or financing, by default, must be operating, because there is nothing else. If it is not this, it must be your main business. And therefore, this is how the definition or how classification of operating works. I just want to, of course, to fully appreciate this, you need to understand how the board proposes to define investing and financing categories. But before I go on to that, I just want to highlight 2 things on this slide that are, I think, important to understand with regards to operating profit. So the first is operating profit subtotal is what we call clean subtotal. It does not include any effects of equity method accounting. In other words, there is no finance income or income taxes bundled with that, which you get with equity method, because equity method presents share of net profit. And why is this important? It's important because it gives users operating profit that is comparable with how revenue has been calculated on consolidated level, and therefore it's quite easy for them to calculate margins without needing to make any adjustments. And the second point is, and this is me just preempting the questions I'm sure you might be typing already, is operating profit. What goes in operating profit does not depend on whether income or expense is considered usual, unusual, non-recurring, recurring. In other words, the board's view is that entities can have both recurring and non-recurring income and expense that arise from its main business activities. And this doesn't mean they're not operating, and therefore they're all part of calculation of operating profit. But at the same time, the board recognized that this characteristic of recurrence is important to investors because investors use information differently depending on whether these are income and expenses that are expected to recur or not, and therefore we have a separate proposals for disclosure of these unusual items, which again Rachel is going to talk about. Rachel, I'm building you up a lot here. So these are the two kind of highlights on the operating profit. I'm just going to go through, explain what is in investing and financing categories, which is on this slide here. So the objective of investing category is to communicate or separately present information about returns from assets that arise independently from other resources of the entity. And what this means in practice is that for most companies, things like interest income on financial investments or dividends income would probably be classified here if it is not relating to their main business activities. And this is useful to users because they often like to analyze these returns separately from entities. Main business activities and their operations. Now, financing category does something different. So the objective of financing categories is to separate and separately communicate about income and expenses, mostly expenses that are related to entities' financing. And in addition to having financing category, the board is proposing to require entities to present a subtotal of profit before financing, which would go between investing and financing categories, which would then enable users to compare entities regardless of their financing decisions or regardless of their capital structure. So what goes into this financing category? I'm just going to explain. You have a few examples on the slide here. So I think one, when we think about financing, we usually first think about interest on debt or maybe interest on lease liabilities. So those things would be indeed captured in the financing category. It is a second bullet here. We also have, in addition to that, income and expenses from cash and cash equivalents. And you might wonder, why is this financing? So the reason it came became part of the financing category because the board concluded that for most entities, cash and cash equivalents were reasonable proxy of investments in cash and excess of entities, investments of excess cash and the excess cash itself, which typical entity would be treated part of the treasury functions, would be netted off against the finance cost, which is how it ended up in this category. And then you see the third item there, which might be familiar from my previous slide on inconsistency on classification. And this is interest relating to liabilities that do not arise from financing activities the way the board has defined financing activities. So this is interest on things like decommissioning liabilities or pensions. So although strictly they don't meet definition of financing, the board thought it was important to set a single location for those so it's easy for users to know where they are, and if they want to make adjustments, they can do that easily. So this is how they ended up in this place. Now, of course, we have a saying, picture is worth more than 1,000 words, and I've been going on about these definitions, and you're probably looking, so what will this look like? So we have an example of what would P&L look like applying these categories and subtotals. And what we see, the biggest one on the top, the gray one, is the operating category and example. So this is not a template, but just example of type of income and expenses that would be in this category and that result in operating profit. And then when we look from the bottom up, you can see the green box. So this is financing category and the example of type of expenses and income that will be classified here. In the middle, we have investing categories. So these are the returns from assets that are independent from other resources of entities, an example of type of income that would be classified in this category. And then we have something else going on, and I haven't mentioned this before, and I'm actually not gonna, I'm gonna keep in suspense for another minute or so in explaining what this subset of associate and JVs are, because the first thing I want to do is explain if this is what it looks like, is this, what does this mean for banks? What does it mean for financial institutions? So when you look at this example, you might say, okay, it makes sense for a general manufacturing company that has, they produce things, they fund things with loans, and the loans are below. But does this mean that the bank would have interest expense that is not part of the operating profit? Well, clearly that wouldn't be a particularly useful outcome. So what the board has done is define situations when, so remember, so from the previous slide, we have operating, investing, and financing, and the problem with banks and companies similar to banks is that things that would normally be financing or investing are part of their main business. So what the board has done is come up with a proposal that defines circumstances in which entities are required to move things from financing or investing or both categories into the operating profit. And these circumstances arise depending on entities' assessment of their main business activities. So you see on the slide three green lines that have been highlighted. So the first one is interest expense, which has been moved from the financing category to operating, and it has been moved on the basis of entities, in this example, assessment that their main business is providing financing to customers. And because their main business is to provide finance to customers, therefore, difference between interest income and interest expense is important for their performance assessment, and therefore, this interest is operating. And the trading income and investment income are items that would otherwise be in investing category, and they are moved into the operating because entity in this example has made assessment that these investments are made in the course of their main business activities, and therefore, again, form important indicator or part of indicator of their operating performance. I hope that's kind of digesting. It's a little bit, it's a lot, I will let you digest that a little bit and maybe just take a minute to explain what was going on with these associate and joint ventures. As Nick warns me, I'm over my time allowance. Associate and joint ventures, what we're doing here is that the board's proposal, and maybe I will illustrate using the slide, The proposal is based on balancing the user's need for a clean subtotal, which I mentioned before, which excludes any equity method accounting. And on the other hand, there are preparers who have asked us to want to present results of some associate and joint ventures that they view integrated with their main business activities as a part of their operating profit. And therefore, the board is proposing to require entities to separately identify associate and joint ventures and divide them between those that are considered integral and those that are considered non-integral to their main business activities and present them separately. So with that, I will stop here.
Well, thank you, Ida, and thank you everyone for your questions. We had lots of questions. Let's try and squeeze in two or three, maybe just be a couple. So first one is, how do you expect conglomerates to present their income statement, especially if there's a mix of banking and traditional industrial production?
I love this question because it's something we spent about 6 months last year working on, and it's a particularly tricky one. We don't have an example on slides here, but basically what I just explained in relation to proposals of how they relate to banks and other financial institutions, they would equally apply to conglomerates. So in other words, if you are a conglomerate, but say if you manufacture produce and you actually finance your customers to buy those produce, you would also apply these proposals in that you would assess if you have a main business activity that is to provide finance to customers, you automatically get to move interest expense up into the operating. The quirk with conglomerates is that not all of their interest may be financing their customer financing business. Some of it might be genuinely financing their manufacturing operations. And in those cases, they can either separate interest into that relates to financing customers and present that as a part of operating, as in this slide, and leave the part that relates to financing their manufacturing below operating profit. But we have heard that in some cases, and I think probably banks are a better example than conglomerates, this becomes quite a difficult exercise, which is why the board is proposing to give a choice to entities to either do the split that I just said, and if they think split is too hard, they can put all of the interest expense in the operating.
Okay, and then we have a question on the share of profits from associates. And specifically, why is that separated or segregated from investing when it seems to be part of it, is the question.
It's indeed, and this was a quite challenging area for the board. I think in the course of board discussions, we probably had every possible permutation of where this equity method accounting can go, and some included far down below, and some included as a part of operating. And I said there's quite different views here, in that for investors, they don't want, regardless of how entities manage, they don't want to see it as a part of operating because they see it. They don't want equity method accounting messing up their margin calculations because equity method is a net number. On the other hand, preparers say, well, they are not just like any investments, you know, they are significant to me and they are part of my supply chain, for example, or we share a brand and I want it in my operating, which is why it kind of got a little bit elevated treatment compared to the investing category, but not quite operating in order to respect what users have asked for in relation to operating profit.
And then just one last question. So we're defining subtotals and categories. Will there be a requirement to actually use the name? So will entities have to use the name operating profit?
They don't have to use, and it's same as what we have today. I think we have a statement of financial position. I think it's very rare that I've seen statement of financial position in the actual annual report. It's most commonly known as balance sheet. So the similar principles would apply, although to be honest with operating, I'm not sure what alternative, because the thing is you can use a different name, but it has to be faithfully representing what it is representing, so you can't suddenly come up and say one is a cat or a dog. It has to be meaningful, so as long as that is met, you can use different descriptions. So, thank you.
Thank you, Aida. We'll move on to some of the other proposals coming out of the project, because improving the structure and of the statement of profit or loss by introducing some categories and subtotals is not the only aspect of the project. We're also proposing changes designed to improve the aggregation and disaggregation of information in the financial statements. That covers aggregation and disaggregation not only in the primary financial statements, so the statement of financial position, the statement of financial performance, and the statement of cash flows, but we're also proposing this guidance on aggregation and disaggregation to apply to the notes. So although the project is titled Primary Financial Statements, it is actually broader than that and can affect the presentation and disclosure of information throughout the financial statements. What we've heard from users is that useful information is often obscured by inappropriate aggregation of information. Equally, if too much information is provided, if there is too much disaggregation, again, it can be quite difficult to understand the financial statements. So what we want to do is to provide some requirements that help preparers think more comprehensively about aggregation and disaggregation and come up with a set of financial statements that provides the information in a way that's useful to users of financial statements. To do that, what we've done is we've outlined a process that preparers can go through when thinking about whether to aggregate or disaggregate information. We've also defined terms such as aggregation and disaggregation and classification. The process that we focus on looks at classifying items of income and expenses, assets, liabilities, and equity based upon whether or not they share similar characteristics. So, for example, do they share a similar measurement basis? Have they a similar nature? Do they share similar risks? And that basis helps you to think about whether they share characteristics and whether you can aggregate the information together. We also focus quite heavily on materiality because, of course, what we want to do is ensure that no material information is obscured by inappropriate aggregation of that information. In addition to that general guidance on aggregation and disaggregation, we are also providing some guidance on aggregation of dissimilar items. Now, this often arises when entities put together balances or items of income and expenses that are individually immaterial, but added together could end up with a very large balance. And they will often describe these items as other. So, for example, you will typically see an other creditors or an other debtors. And users of financial statements find this description of other incredibly frustrating, particularly if the balances are large, because they don't really know what's going on, what's included in that balance, what information are they potentially missing by these aggregations of information. So what we're asking preparers to do is to look at those balances that are described as other and look and see if actually they should be further disaggregated. In some cases, they may be characteristics that they can split out to result in information that is more disaggregated and provides useful information. In other situations, what we ask the preparers to do is to say, okay, let's have a look at these balances and see whether other is actually the right title for these balances. Could I give a title to these amounts that actually faithfully represents what's included in them? So rather than other creditors, you could say, expand on it and say something like other trade creditors associated with this particular business aspect. So looking at providing a little bit more information about what is included in those balances. Finally, if you decide that further disaggregation isn't required and you are still struggling to come up with a label that appropriately describes what's included in a particular balance, what we then said is that you should provide some information about what is included in the balance. So, for example, you could explain what the largest amount is included in a balance. So if you have, again, something like other debtors, you would say other debtors include amounts not exceeding X, where X would be an immaterial amount, and give an indication of the nature of those debtors. So again, just giving users a little bit more information so that they can get comfortable that they are not missing any material information that is included in these balances that aggregate dissimilar items. So we're looking at, can I advance? So we have this general guidance on aggregation and disaggregation, but we're also providing some more specific guidance on the disaggregation of information in the statement of financial performance, in particular in the statement of profit or loss, and in particular in relation to operating expenses. We will be requiring entities to present an analysis of expenses either by nature or by function. Now, entities are required to do that today, but they don't necessarily do it on a consistent basis, and you will sometimes see a mixture of by nature and by function provided. We'll make it clear in our proposals that an entity must pick either by nature or by function and apply that. A mixture of the two approaches will not be allowed. In addition, the current requirements which would allow an entity to provide that analysis of by function or by nature, either on the face of the statement of profit or loss or in the notes, will be removed. An entity must provide their analysis of by function or by nature on the statement of financial performance. They can't just do it in the notes. It's also important to point out that our proposals will say it is not a free choice for an entity to pick either by function or by nature analysis of expenses. They must decide which of those approaches is likely to provide the most useful information to the users of financial statements and present the information in that way. In addition to that, what we've been told by many users of financial statements is that they always find information about the nature of the expenses useful because they can use that in their analysis, and it's easier for them to analyse what an increase or decrease in particular natural expense line items would do in terms of their forecasting. So as a result, we're going to require entities always to provide information about the nature of their income and expenses. So in a situation where an entity has chosen a functional analysis of expenses, they will be required in the notes to the financial statements to provide an analysis of the expenses by nature. We originally considered whether we should require entities to analyse each functional line item and provide the nature of each functional line item. However, we decided against doing that as discussions with preparers told us that in many cases that would be extremely difficult for them to do. Instead, the analysis of the nature of the expenses, of operating expenses, will be required in total rather than for each functional line item. Moving on to the next area, which is in relation to unusual items. Users of financial statements often tell us that what they want to do is to find information about non-recurring or non-persistent items of income and expense. This helps them to forecast future cash flows because then they can remove items which they think will not recur in the future from their forecasts of future cash flows. Some entities seek to identify unusual items today and provide information about them in their financial statements. But this isn't done on a consistent basis. And there tends sometimes to be a bias towards entities providing information about what they regard as unusual or non-recurring expenses, but entities rarely identify income as unusual or non-recurring. So what we're trying to do is to provide some more consistency around the disclosure of this information that users have told us is very important to them. We're proposing to provide a definition of unusual items, and it's up on the slide there. Unusual income and expenses are those with limited predictive value. We go on to explain what we mean by limited predictive value, and we say it is when it is reasonable to expect that income or expenses that are similar in type and amount will not arise for several future reporting periods. Now, just to explain what that means, an entity could have impairments every single year. And if those impairments are of a similar amount, then it would not be permitted to classify these as unusual. They do not meet the definition that we have described of unusual. But let's say in one particular year, there is a very significant impairment. It's much larger than the periodic impairments that we see every single year. In that sort of situation, the entity would be able to classify that as an unusual item, and we would require additional disclosures around that unusual item. We're requiring information about the unusual item to be disclosed in the notes, and so you will get a description of why the entity believes it to be unusual and other information to help users assess whether or not that is something that they want to factor into their analysis. Moving on to an area that always causes a lot of comment and debate whenever we discuss, and that's in relation to management performance measures. As you know, lots of entities these days present information using either alternative performance measures or non-GAAP measures. And again, users of financial statements tell us that they find this information quite useful, but they complain that it lacks transparency and discipline. It lacks this transparency and discipline. They don't really understand why or how an entity has calculated these alternative performance measures. Our proposals are designed to shine a light onto this particular area of reporting by bringing disclosures around management performance measures into the financial statements, potentially making them subject to audit, and also providing better disclosures about why this particular item of information has been provided to the investors. The definition of management performance measures are included in the slide. They are things that are used in public communications with users of financial statements outside those financial statements. And the information is designed to complement the totals or subtotals included in IFRS standards. I think that's a really important point to make. These management performance measures are not intended to replace the IFRS-defined subtotals or IFRS-defined information. We think that that provides the most useful information in the financial statements. However, we do acknowledge that there are aspects of performance that maybe an entity wants to communicate and can complement the information that is required by IFRS standards, and that's what the management performance measure requirements are intended to do. They're intended to communicate management's view, and so we have disclosures that make it very clear to any users that these aren't IFRS-defined pieces of information, rather they're pieces of information that are defined by management itself, and so it's not necessarily comparable between different entities. There are a whole host of disclosures around the management performance measures, but I just want to highlight what I think is probably the most important of those disclosures, which is the requirement to produce a reconciliation between the management performance measure and the most directly comparable subtotal required by IFRS standards. In this case, in the example on the slide, what we're doing is we're looking to reconcile the management performance measure of adjusted operating profit to operating profit. And you can see here that the entity has two reconciling items, restructuring expenses and impairment. So each of the adjustments between the comparable IFRS subtotal and the management performance measure must be provided. In addition to that, we've been told by users of financial statements that they want information about the tax effect and the effect on non-controlling interests of the adjustments made between them, the management performance measures and the IFRS required subtotals. The reason they want that information is to allow them to adjust for those adjustments. So a user may decide that actually, in this example, they think it's legitimate to remove the impairment expenses from the operating profit, but actually they want to keep the restructuring expenses in operating profit. And having information about the tax and NCI effects of these adjustments allows them to do that at the net profit level, so they can calculate what the effect on net profit of including or excluding each of these adjustments within their analysis. We realise that calculating the tax effect can actually be quite complex and quite difficult for entities to do, so we have a simplified approach proposed to allow entities to calculate the tax effect of these adjustments. Most of our proposals have been focusing on the statement of financial performance with some additional information around the notes. We're also proposing some limited changes to the statement of cash flows. We're not doing a fundamental rethink of the statement of cash flows. We really are just looking at a couple of areas which users have highlighted cause them particular concerns. These are in relation to the starting point of the indirect reconciliation of operating cash flows, and also in relation to a number of options that are available for the classification of interest and dividends. We're proposing to require a single starting point for the indirect reconciliation, and we're proposing that that should be the operating profit subtotal that we are proposing as part of these package of proposals. The second area is in relation to interest and dividends. We're going to be removing a number of the options for the presentation of interest and dividends, which means that for many non-financial entities, there will be a single place in which these interest and dividends will be provided. So interest paid and dividends paid will be in the financing section. Interest received and dividends received will be in the investing section. It's slightly more complicated for financial entities, but generally speaking, the classification of the cash flows will follow the related income and expenses in the profit or loss. So that is a very quick run through the main proposals in the Primary Financial Statements Project, but do we have any questions?
We have lots of questions. I do apologise, we won't be able to answer all of them, but the three of us will be available at the end of the session if there's any really burning issues you'd like us to address. But the first one's on unusual items. And conceptually, how do these differ from extraordinary or exceptional items?
Okay, in relation to extraordinary items, I think they're very different. Extraordinary items, if you recall, were included in IS1 up until I'm trying to remember when, but it's quite a few years ago when the extraordinary items were removed. But extraordinary items were presented after tax, right at the bottom of the profit and loss account. And so, in effect, it sends a bit of a message that you could ignore these particular items, these extraordinary items, from your analysis. We disagree with that. We think unusual items are part of the performance of an entity, and indeed, in many cases, will be part of the operating performance of an entity. And so, unusual items will be included in operating profit, in financing, in investing, depending upon the underlying transactions that arise from it. So in relation to the difference between unusual and extraordinary, I think they are very different. I think there probably are some similarities between our concept of unusual items and exceptional items. What we're trying to do here is to highlight items that potentially are non-recurring or non-persistent in terms of the performance of the entity. So I think there are some similarities there. Where I'm hoping that our proposals will help is that we're providing much more guidance in terms of how to identify these with definitions of what we mean by unusual items and additional disclosures to help people provide the information that users really need about this. So hopefully that answers the question.
And so then there was a question on aggregation, disaggregation. In terms of the use of the word other, did we consider quantitative thresholds? So 10% of a particular class, for instance.
Yes, we did indeed. That was one of the suggestions that was put to the board, was whether we wanted some quantitative thresholds. So saying that if, for example, other creditors was more than 10% of a particular balance, then we would require further disaggregation of that 10%. We decided not to go down to that approach, as we felt it was a fairly sort of arbitrary rule in terms of splitting out the information in that way, and may not always provide the best information. We thought a more principled approach that described the sorts of things that an entity could do to provide better information about those other balances would be a better approach to take.
And then lastly, and it's a big picture question, so how do we reconcile the need companies to tell their own story with putting more definition in to the statement of profit or loss?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because clearly there is a balance that has to be struck here. What users tell us is that they want two things. They want entities to have the ability to tell their own story in the financial statements, which means much more entity-specific information, but they also want comparability of information. And so we have to strike a balance between the two. And what we heard from a lot of users was that what they want is more comparability, for example, in the primary financial statements, where they go for their initial analysis. And then if they want more information about entity-specific facts, they can then go to the notes. So what we're seeing is a lot more structure and a lot more comparability in the statement of financial performance in particular than you're seeing at the moment. But then that does mean that the information that is entity-specific will be found in the notes and will be available, and entities can still tell their own story in a useful way.
Thank you.
So we've been through all of the proposals. There are six main areas where we have key proposals. Aida talked to you about the defined subtotals and categories in the statement of profit or loss. I walked you through the principles and guidance for aggregation and disaggregation. We're amending the requirements in terms of analysis of operating expenses, so amending them to be much clearer about what we mean by nature and function and what needs to be provided there. We're introducing disclosures around unusual items and around management performance measures, and we're introducing some targeted improvements to the statement of cash flows. All of these proposals should result in more relevant information and, in relation to the management performance measures, greater transparency and discipline around how those measures are provided. What I would say, and it sort of follows on from this notion of entities telling their own stories and the need for comparability and how those can sometimes be in tension, is that all of these changes will actually be beneficial for entities who are using electronic reporting. As I'm sure you're aware, electronic reporting is being increasingly used by preparers and by financial statement users. And what we find is that electronic reporting works best when you have more structure around some of these items. And so, again, I think these proposals will help entities that have a need to provide information in an electronic format. I think it's useful just to make a couple of comments about the structure of the exposure draft itself, because it's going to be slightly unusual. We're going to send out an exposure draft that will propose a new IFRS standard. We're tentatively calling it IFRS 18. If anybody jumps in before us, then it might be IFRS 19, but we're hoping it's going to be IFRS 18. They will include all the new requirements that we've been talking through today in relation to the structure and content of the financial statements. And it will also bring forward any related requirements from IS1. So any of the presentation and disclosure requirements in IS1 that have not been affected by this project will still be brought forward into this new standard. There will be some limited changes to those paragraphs that are brought forward from existing IS1, but those changes will be limited to situations where we're looking to for consistency with the new requirements and also for consistency with the revised conceptual framework. All other requirements of IS1, so those requirements that have not been brought forward into the new standard, will be moved to IS8 and IFRS 7. We will then withdraw IS1. There will be a number of other amendments to standards. So our proposals in relation to the statements of cash flows will result in amendments to IS 7, but we will also be proposing some minor amendments to IS 33, IS 34, and IFRS 12. And the changes to IFRS 12 are designed to implement the proposals Aida described in relation to associates and joint ventures, which I think takes us towards the end of what we were going to be asking today, but I think we have a polling question.
So we would like everyone to take out your crystal balls and open Slido and think about what feedback you think there will be on these proposals in your jurisdiction. So we have, when you open the Slido, you'll have two questions. One will be what proposals you think will be well received in your jurisdiction, and the other one being which proposals you think might be contentious in your jurisdiction. We are not holding you to account. I'm not going to cross-check this against comment letters we eventually receive from you, but we thought it might be good to just see, get some indication of what we expect to hear in this consultation. On the Slido, you will also see a final question that allows you to enter any further thoughts you have, if you wish to give any specific comments, which the team will then, we will consider after and take into account as we plan our outreach. So subtotals are looking popular, which is good. That's consistent with the feedback we've had so far, as well as proposals for unusual. Okay, there's a bit of competition here between, which is good. That means everything is receiving hits and will be appreciated. Okay, so we have reached 50, 63. I think we had 65 in previous questions, was it? Is it a good time to stop and just take a look? Of course, what we have explained today is a quite high-level overview. There is a number of kind of details around the proposals that we didn't have time to go through, so you will have opportunity to do that when you see completed exposure draft and also when we have outreach in your jurisdictions or a talk to you. But this is certainly helpful for us as a guide, and maybe we can look on the flip side, Gloria, on the other part of the questions. Which proposals do you think will be contentious? Okay, so the numbers are lower there. It doesn't go above 27, and management performance measures are there on top, which I think is consistent, Rachel, with how you framed up this discussion, in that there is a bit of, let's say, unease about bringing non-GAAP numbers, which sometimes are considered as bad numbers, into IFRS world. But, you know, with transparency and discipline, that should actually enhance financial reporting. So we will work on that. And then the other proposals got some hits as well.
Okay, so thank you. That's great. It's very great information for us to have. I think we're all just about out of time. Mary is on the way up already. She tells me that's the case. Thank you for all of your questions. If you have any issues that you'd like to pick up after the session, please come and find us. My thanks to Rachel and Ivy, especially for doing all the hard work this session. But thank you as well.
You've anticipated very well my first point, which is to express thanks to the PFS team, who did a great job here. A couple of things I've been asked to remind you about. I think this is the last time I'm going to nag you about the dinner sign-up. If you said yes and your plans have changed, please check with reception and so that they can update on that. The second thing I've been asked to remind you about is the breakouts for this afternoon's carousel of sessions. The breakout assignments are not an accounting policy choice. They are mandatory requirements of the conference. And the reason I say it this way is because we had to juggle which rooms, you know, based on the sign-ups for the number of seats, because they are not all the same size, and we don't have a lot of flexibility in terms of which rooms people are in. So if you could check the sheet to see which sessions you're in, that would be very helpful. Now, lunch is now available just in the foyer, just outside the main doors. If you check, there are ingredient labels, so you can figure out if you have dietary restrictions, which items you can and can't have. And we will be reconvening in here at 2 p.m. to talk about goodwill and impairment. So fortify yourself with lunch for an active session starting at 2 o'clock. Thanks again.